DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this program, Turkey wants international museums to return historical artifacts.
Some were taken out with some sort of legal formulation in the past. Others were looted from our historical sites. I'm fighting to get back our historical artifacts that went illegally to the big museums of the world.
Gay opposition activists in Syria.
Personally, I see homosexuality as a private matter. But Syrian society would say no way if gays rose to claim their rights.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. In many regions, neighboring countries need to find solutions how to use the water resources that are so vital to people's survival. Jordan River is one example. Today, it's a polluted wasteland of brackish, contaminated water. Its banks and tributaries are shared by Israel, Jordan, Syria and the West Bank. But the failure of the governments to cooperate multilaterally has seen efforts to rehabilitate the river dry up, along with the river itself. Now the international community is turning to an independent NGO in a last-ditch effort to turn back the clock. Vanessa O'Brien has the story.
Here in the middle of the bone-dry Middle East desert, the mighty Jordan River once gushed life-giving fresh water. Its lush wetland ecosystem was the life source of agrarian villages and cities, little green oases on an otherwise barren brown landscape. 1.3 billion cubic metres of water a year cut out the Jordan's path from Syria in the north to the Dead Sea in the south. Today it's a mere trickle, just 20 to 30 million cubic metres, and what's left is filthy. It's the sewage runoff from Jordanian, Israeli and Palestinian villages that house more than 300,000 people in communities along the Jordan's banks. These three governments have the most strategic interest in restoring the river to health, but they can't agree on trilateral action due to territorial disputes and a reluctance to invest water in nature, according to Friends of Earth Middle East director Gideon Bromberg.
The demise of the river is very much due to the mindset of conflict, competition of the enemy. Everyone wants to capture water for themselves, but also to deny the enemy water resources.
In order to tackle this problem, Friends of Earth Middle East, an independent NGO, is working with the Stockholm International Water Institute and Global Nature Fund. They are investing €3 million in the development of a plan to restore the lower Jordan River basin to health.
The Jordan River was never the Mississippi, but it was a river, for instance, that was able to be harnessed and move turbines to produce electricity. Today, the Jordan wouldn't turn a mouse wheel.
Israel began operating a major dam to divert water from the Sea of Galilee in 1964. That same year, Jordan constructed a channel to divert water from the Yarmouk River, a main tributary of the Jordan River. Syria also built reservoirs to catch the Yarmouk's waters. Between the three countries, 70 to 90% of the Jordan's resource is diverted for human use. The daunting job that the master plan's writers have is twofold. First, they have to create scenarios based on possible future borders. Then they need to convince the governments of Israel, Jordan and Syria to release more than 400 million cubic metres of water per year to restore the Jordan's flow. The West Bank also borders the Jordan River, but Palestinians don't have access to its waters. Dr. Nadir Al-Khatib is a Palestinian director of Friends of Earth Middle East. He says it's crucial that Palestinians participate in the master plan and have input into the future of the Jordan River Valley.
The Jordan Valley is our land. It's the food basket for the Palestinians. It's the future of our economy. And the Jordan River is the political border between Palestine and Jordan.
Adel Yassin from the Palestinian Water Authority agrees.
The Israeli should admit that we have rights in the Jordan River Valley and tributaries, and we are partners for these water resources. After that, we can work together.
Palestinian territory is far downstream from where Jordan diverts the Yarmouk River. so Jordan collects its water share in accordance with the agreement it has with Syria and Israel. And by the time the Jordan River trickles past Palestinian territory, it is little more than raw sewage. It's unlikely that Jordan will voluntarily reduce its water allocation from the river and allow more fresh water to flow to aid its restoration. Jordan is one of the world's 10 most water-poor countries. Even taps in its capital, Amman, run dry from time to time. Releasing more water to the Jordan River will not only restore the river itself, but also the Dead Sea into which it flows, says Friends of Earth Middle East Israel director Gideon Bromberg. He thinks Israel should be the first to take the plunge.
We think that Israel should lead, because Israel is the economic powerhouse of the region.
Israel's world-leading clean tech industry nets more than $2 billion a year in exports. Bromberg says Israel should use this technology at home to design a system that reuses shower water to flush toilets. This way Israel could save 220 million cubic metres of water each year and release more water back to the Jordan River. However, Israel is also a water-poor country. It has 45% less water than it needs to meet the country's water demands and makes up for the loss through an expensive desalination program. Friends of Earth Middle East Israel director Gideon Bromberg argues there are economic kickbacks to rehabilitating the Jordan.
We're highlighting the economic opportunities because the river is just not important for nature, but it's also perhaps the holiest river on this planet. There are millions of pilgrims that want to visit the River Jordan and are very limited as to where that visitation can take place today.
Friends of Earth Middle East is already making progress in the region. By the end of this year, no Israeli waste will flow into the Jordan, thanks to a $30 million investment in a new wastewater treatment plant. Jordan is also following suit with a wastewater treatment plant planned for its biggest communities along the Jordan Valley, and the Japanese government has approved funds for a wastewater treatment plant in the Palestinian city of Jericho. Bromberg isn't naive about the challenges that lie ahead for Friends of Earth Middle East's Jordan River Valley project, but he is positive about the possibilities.
With the support that we do have, very broad support of the public, we believe we'll get there.
Vanessa O'Brien, DW, Jerusalem.
And we're remaining in the region for our next report. As the fighting in Syria continues violently, the various groups opposed to the regime are positioning themselves for a post-Assad Syria. One of these groups we rarely hear about are Syria's gay men and lesbians. In a country where homosexuality is illegal, the uprising has raised hopes that their rights will be recognized. One Syrian gay man has been trying to raise awareness among the gay community with an online magazine. But it's a challenging task. Not only does he face opposition from the regime and conservative Islamists, but also from some secular opposition activists. Reese Ehrlich met Mahmoud Hasino in the Turkish border town of Antakya.
Sitting in the safety of his sparse, rented room in Turkey, 37-year-old Syrian Mahmoud Hasino relaxes to the songs of Alyssa, a gay icon in Syria. In his native country, Hasino can't even discuss that Alyssa is a gay favorite, let alone raise the issue of gay rights. When he came out to his mother as a teenager, he says she gave him good advice.
She just wanted me to stay away from family or keep the subject to myself. Nobody will accept this. And I will have so much trouble finding work and socializing with people, which is true. I mean, her point of view is true.
Being in the cultures that you were in must have been incredibly difficult to find a partner.
No. There are gay men everywhere. You just need a good gaydar.
Homosexuality in Syria is illegal, and despite promises of reform by President Bashar al-Assad when he first took office in 2000, it remains so today. In 2010, the government arrested groups of gay men who were having parties at private houses. A few men were arrested on drug charges.
The rest of them were kept for 3 months until everybody in their families and neighborhoods found out that they were gay. Some of them had to flee Syria. actually, this is a bigger problem than the law now for homosexuals. The social traditions, which are actually influenced by the religious traditions, actually. Most people normally reject homosexuality, reject the idea.
Hacino says that while gay men face harassment, lesbians face even more difficulties.
Lesbians face more troubles everywhere. But in Syria, for example, I know a friend of mine who, her sister found out about her homosexuality. So the family forced her to marry an older guy, and she's living now like a maid, taking care of him and his children. This is their way of dealing with her homosexuality.
Despite this oppression, Hacino says some gay men and lesbians still support Assad. They fear that if conservative Islamists come to power, they would be even more repressed. He started the online magazine Mawala, which means nuts, in an effort to reach out to his community, regardless of their political views.
Nobody will know what will happen in Syria, actually, until the regime falls. And this is something we need to work on, actually, raising awareness. We want a secular Syria. Even the pro-regime, if they want a secular Syria, they need to have a backup plan.
Many gay and lesbian Syrians have fled to nearby Turkey. As a refugee, Hacino faced the same problems as thousands of other refugees.
When I first arrived, I didn't have much money. So one time I was walking by a mosque, and it was prayer time, so I decided just to go inside and try my luck. With reading Quran out loud, I might be able... Actually, I was thinking I might find job teaching Quran to people, but people started inviting me. I needed a free meal, at least, so, yeah, I did it for a while.
As a not particularly religious gay man, I asked how he felt reading the Quran to devout Muslims.
It was weird for me sometimes. I would feel funny, especially with hot men trying to learn how to read Quran.
You couldn't tell them that, though.
Well, of course, yeah, of course.
Mahmoud Hacino is an out gay man while he's in exile, but his views are very controversial, even among the secular opposition. Miral Broretta is a secular leader of the local coordinating committees in a central Syrian city.
Personally, I see homosexuality as a private matter. But Syrian society would say no way if gays rose to claim their rights. Developing a civil society will take time.
Others are less tolerant. Nasrin Ahmed, a member of the Free Syrian Army, considers himself part of the secular opposition.
If I was in charge, I would enforce tougher laws against homosexuals. My opinion is based on the social and religious traditions in Syria. If someone said homosexuals should be stoned to death, as in Iran and Saudi Arabia, I would not object.
Hacino says that homosexuals will face challenges whoever wins Syria's civil war. In the long run, he says, the only way to change the conservative social values is to win the right for all Syrians to organize and speak freely.
The most important thing for us is to have some social acceptance. And without a freedom of speech, we cannot address these issues. In Syria, any kind of gathering is punishable by law. I mean, the intelligence services, they will just come and arrest people if they're gathering, discussing any kind of social change or political change.
Hacino is trying to do his part by publishing the online magazine. A second issue comes out in September.
For more information on what's going on in Syria and the region, please check out our webpage at dw.de. Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about Turkey demanding European museums to return historical artifacts. But first, here's a quick glance at some development news. Democracy declines worldwide. Democratic governments declined throughout the world in 2011, showing that gains made in the Middle East and North Africa during the Arab Spring are very fragile and leaders may slip back into authoritarian rule. That's according to the annual report by US watchdog Freedom House. The report says only Tunisia has improved markedly its overall governance score amongst the Middle East North African countries, while Bahrain slipped backward and Egypt edged up only slightly. Worldwide, declines in the quality of governments of the 72 surveyed countries far exceeded improvements. Jordan endorses controversial media law. Jordan's king has endorsed a controversial new media law that critics say could severely stifle online expression. The law requires 400 news websites operated by Jordanians to register with the government and obtain licenses. It also gives authorities the power to block and censor the sites and holds publishers and editors liable for posted comments. Human rights activists say the legislation would make website managers share the responsibility for posted comments. Rights group says Bangladesh divorce law discriminates women. Bangladesh's laws on separation and divorce often trap women in abusive marriages, according to Human Rights Watch. The report released Monday by the New York-based group says the current laws deprive women of an equal right to property when a marriage is dissolved. This means women and their children are prone to remain in bad relationships or wind up homeless, hungry, and without access to proper health care when their marriages fall apart, the report said. UNHCR Nansen Refugee Prize goes to Somali woman. Somalia's Hawa Aden Mohammed has been awarded the 2012 Nansen Refugee Prize. Mohammed, founder and director of the Galkayo Education Center for Peace and Development, GECPD, in northeastern Somalia, is a former refugee who chose to return to her country in 1995. UNHCR says that she set up an ambitious education program to assist people uprooted by Somalia's persistent conflict and recurring droughts. If you visit an archaeological museum anywhere in the world, the likelihood some of the displays will be from Turkey. The country is home to countless civilizations dating back thousands of years and remains a favorite location for international archaeologists. But now the Turkish government has launched an aggressive policy of seeking the return of artifacts from around the world that it claims were looted from this country. That policy, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, could have serious implications for many of the world's museums and for international archaeology.
The opening ceremony of a new archaeological museum in the western Turkish city of Izmir is just the latest step in the country's museum revolution. New museums are springing up across the country, with more planned, while established ones have had expensive makeovers. Turkish Culture Minister Ertuğrul Günay is the mastermind behind the ambitious project that aims to harness Turkey's rich heritage. But as Günay made clear in the opening of this latest museum, his revolution has international implications.
When you visit the world's big museums in the US, England, France, or Germany, you see that most of the precious artifacts came from Turkey, Italy, Egypt, and Greece. Some were taken out with some sort of legal formulation in the past. Others were looted from our historical sites. I'm fighting to get back our historical artifacts that went illegally to the big museums of the world.
This is not just political rhetoric. Along with pursuing court cases against high-profile museums, Günay has introduced a policy of boycotting international institutions housing contested Turkish relics. The minister vetoed this year lending artefacts to a major exhibition by the British Museum until it returned artefacts Ankara claims were illegally removed. Nezi Başgelen, editor of a leading Turkish archaeological magazine, says the policy could have far-reaching consequences for museums around the world.
We have some lists, many lists for the Germany, for the United Kingdom, for the United States, for France, for Italy, and for the other countries, for the, maybe Austria, more than the thousands pieces. Some ceramic materials, too much. Some of them coins, many coins. Many marble things, the sarcophages and big statues, many things.
Turkey's rich past is still a favorite for archaeologists from around the world. That popularity has also been seen by the Turkish Ministry of Culture as a means to apply pressure. Ankara threatened to suspend a German archaeologist's permit on a major site unless Berlin's Pergamon Museum returned a disputed artifact back to Turkey. The museum eventually complied. It's believed Ankara is considering using such pressure again in order to have relics returned. But Felix Pearson, director of the German Archaeological Institute in Turkey, says such a policy hurts everyone.
Die müssen sich so vorstellen, dass die Türkei ein Laboratorium ist.
Turkey is a laboratory for modern archaeology where different scientific traditions and international scientists are coming together. This cooperation must prevail and continue. This kind of political tit-for-tat is poisoning such cooperation.
That plea may be falling on deaf ears. Turkey's archaeological past is now a key part of its drive to attract tourists, with commercials like this one promoting the country as a destination that offers more than just sun and beaches. Part of that policy includes building one of the world's largest archaeological museums in the capital, Ankara. Turkish archaeological magazine editor Bash Gelin worries about the fallout from the controversy, but believes a win-win solution is possible.
If we broke some things, we can't improve some projects and for some friendship or for some collaboration possibilities for the future. We can lost many things. If we discuss logically, we can find some solutions. Maybe to keep them on for a loan for 40, 49 years. They can stay with these museums. And there, everybody can see these pieces. And then everybody wants to see the original place.
But voices of moderation are being lost in the fiery political rhetoric, with the Minister of Culture claiming the issue is as much about national honour and the righting of a centuries-old wrong. What's more, Turkey is enlisting international allies in its battle. An agreement with Greece has been signed to join forces in their struggle to return artefacts to their place of origin. And negotiations are continuing with Italy and Egypt. The implications of Turkey's stance on the ownership of relics could be far-reaching for the world's greatest archaeological museums. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And our last story today is also very international. It's been 10 years since the start of Radio Jojo, an international radio project by and for children. Young people aged 3 to 18 from all over the world are participating in it. They discuss everything from the environment to cultural issues. The internet video conferencing program Skype makes their talks possible. And people are starting to pay attention. Radio Jojo was named an official project of the United Nations Decade of Education. Svenja Ueing has listened to the program in the internet and talked to one of its initiators. Charlotte Lomas presents their story.
Hello, Radio Jojo. Hello, Kinder.
Radio Jojo's youngest hosts were still in diapers not that long ago. Little Alexei and his colleagues attend the daycare centre, Kleine August, in Berlin.
Hey, ich bin's Alexei. Wir haben heute etwas ganz Besonderes für euch. Wollt ihr reinhören?
Hallo? 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 On the other end of Alexei's Skype connection are children in the daycare centre called Sunshine, located in Moscow, some 1,600 kilometres away. It's not just distance that separates these two classrooms from one another, but Radio Jojo aims to change that.
Меня зовут Наташа.
Меня зовут Адриан.
Меня зовут Андрей.
Wie heißt ihr?
Ich heiße Hauke und bin 5 Jahre alt.
Who brings you Christmas presents? What kind of food do you like most? The kids talk to each other in a very direct way. Translators enable them to communicate. And that's exactly the point. Even the youngest kids are able to learn something about what it means to live in another country and another culture.
Ich heiße Lara.
Elin.
Ich heiße Daniel und bin 4 Jahre alt.
Anton.
Lily.
Ich bin Aisha.
Richard.
Radio Jojo has been creating radio broadcasts for kids and youth for the past 10 years. The commercial-free program reaches out to children aged 3 to 13. But older students sometimes get on board for special projects. The program's formats can range from a short jingle to a 60-minute show. That takes training, which is what the kids are getting. They learn how to digitally edit audio, conduct good interviews, and voice texts. And even the teeny tiny ones develop and research their own ideas, says Wolfgang Fischer, producer at Radio Jojo.
First of all, it is very important that the children develop a capacity for using their voice, that they learn that each child has something special to offer.
Radio Jojo was born a decade ago in Berlin's Wedding District, one often described as a problem zone, with many poor people living in the neighbourhood. But now Radio Jojo cooperates with children and youth in 100 different countries, taking on subjects from social justice to fair trade and climate change. These topics are also included in the United Nations Millennium Development Goals.
Eight different topics have been formulated there. We take care of all of them: education, climate change, and health. AIDS and HIV are also big topics when we work with children from Africa.
In early 2012, Radio Jojo kicked off a new project in the Arabic-speaking regions of North Africa.
With the wave of democratization rolling across the area and the demands we sense there, we want to reach out to the young people in the region and promote dialogue.
The target group for this new project are students, and one question that's at the heart of the conversation is, how do we envisage our future? The 20 to 25-year-olds taking part chose the topic themselves. It's a way for them to talk about the educational opportunities available in their countries. This year, the Radio Jojo team will travel to Morocco 4 times for 2 weeks to get the project up and running.
Education is the cornerstone of any developing society. It is the key through which we can improve our life, our life standards, express ourselves, and speak our minds. But in Morocco, education is anything but organized, successful, and powerful system.
Shows like this are broadcast via 24-hour internet streams, as well as by several partner stations around the world. Among them are Pacifica Radio Network in the United States and the World Association of Community Radios and various community radio programs in Germany.
There are children who still live in there. They face plenty of problems. They have to walk half an hour.
Radio Jojo organizers don't know exactly how many listeners they have, says Fischer, but approximate numbers are known.
What we know is that some shows technically have a range of 10 million listeners, but not all of them will be listening to the program at the same time.
That may sound like a lot, but in Germany at least, even among diehard radio lovers, Radio Jojo is not very well known.
It's mostly people in the developmental policy and educational arenas who are familiar with us, the expert world, so to speak.
Funding for Radio Jojo comes mainly from donations, foundations, and public sponsorships. The money is then utilized for individual projects. But Radio Jojo doesn't enjoy a fixed budget, which is why its 30 or 40 project managers are always busy writing new funding proposals, even though the staff sometimes wish their show had more publicity or better financing. It's the enthusiasm from the kids and young people that renews their faith in their work. Charlotte Lomas for DW.
And that report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. Next week, one of our reports will look at the changing tides in Canada and what that means for international cooperation. For that and more, tune in again next week at the same time. In the meantime, check out other stories on development and globalization online at dw.de/globalization. For today, on behalf of our Bonn studio team, Marion Kulina and Geli Pirk, it's all the best from me, Anke Raspa, and goodbye.